Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, September 23, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on border searches, national security, and the reasonable expectation of privacy, of digital privacy. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I am the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, the opinions of today's experts are not necessarily reflective of their employees or employers. Today, we welcome Brian House, Legal Fellow at the ACLU Speech, Technology, and Privacy Project. Our second expert is Andrew Levy, Senior Counsel at Accenture. More complete bios for our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. We'll begin first with Mr. Brian House. Mr. House, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Christian. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Christian mentioned, I'm a legal fellow with the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. The project focuses on a variety of issues ranging from political protest, freedom of expression online, privacy of electronic information, journalist rights, scientific freedom, and openness in the courts. Earlier this year, in United States versus Cotterman, an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit held that the government needs reasonable suspicion to engage in a forensic examination of laptops and similar types of electronic devices at the border. So, although Cotterman does not require the government to have suspicion to open a traveler's laptop and look around for suspicious files that may be available on the desktop, any further examination of password-protected files, deleted files, et cetera, using forensic software will require reasonable suspicion now under Cotterman. And the question we're here to discuss today is whether this reasonable suspicion requirement is a good idea. To throw some factual light on this issue, I would like to describe another case, one that the ACLU has recently settled with the federal government. The case is called House versus Napolitano. I think this case actually sheds a lot of light on the sort of issues presented by suspicionless searches of laptops and other electronic devices at the border. David House is a computer programmer and political activist from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was at one time deeply involved in the Bradley Manning Support Network, which, as some of you may remember, was a group that came around shortly after the WikiLeaks disclosures to raise funds for the legal defense of Bradley Manning. The government wanted to question House in connection with this WikiLeaks investigation. Specifically, I believe it was the Department of State, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Justice were all interested in getting some information from House. But there was no basis for believing that he'd committed any criminal activities. And so what the Department of Homeland Security did was they set up an alert on the government's text database to basically notify them whenever House left the country. The text database is connected to the Advanced Passenger Information System, which notifies government agents in advance when a person intends to leave the country. It explains what their itinerary is, when they're coming back. So several months after this alert was set up, the government received a notification that House would be leaving the country for Mexico and that he would be returning through Chicago O'Hare. When House got into the Chicago O'Hare airport, several DHS agents were waiting for him at the gate. They took him into custody, confiscated his laptop, his cell phone, his USB drive, his camera, and then interrogated him about his political activities in connection with WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning. They returned his phone after the interrogation was over, but they held on to the rest of the devices. They took them to DHS headquarters in New York, or one of the headquarters, where they made a forensic copy of all the information stored on the devices. And they held on to the devices while they were trying to go through them for about 7 weeks, at which point the ACLU became involved in the case. And after we sent a demand letter to the government, very shortly thereafter, the devices were returned, even though the government held on to the information and continued to analyze the files in House's possession for about seven more months. So the ACLU filed a lawsuit on House's behalf. We raised First and Fourth Amendment claims. Our Fourth Amendment claim was that the government needed some quantum of suspicion to search his devices, even at the border. We argued that they needed reasonable suspicion to search his laptops. We also argued that the prolonged seizure of his devices was unreasonable without any suspicion. And we argued that the government violated House's First Amendment rights by targeting him on the basis of his political activities in connection with the Bradley Manning support network. The government filed a motion to dismiss, which the district court denied. The district court held that although the government does not need reasonable suspicion to search laptops at the border, that it was at least plausible that the continued seizure of his laptop for 7 weeks does require some amount of suspicion to actually be reasonable, and that House raised a valid First Amendment claim, in essence, that the government can't target people on the basis of their political activities, even if it is free to engage in suspicionless searches at the border. Now, what I think is interesting about the House case and the way I think it illuminates the issues in Cotterman, I think there are several points, actually, that go to the issues about suspicionless laptop searches. First, what I think is notable is that the government used the documents revealed through the case revealed that the government didn't have any suspicion for House. They didn't believe that he was bringing contraband into the country. The real purpose of the search was to get information that they couldn't have gotten inside the country. So I think this case presents an example of the government using its border search powers for reasons entirely unrelated to customs and more really about law enforcement. And I think that's troubling, at least insofar as we believe that the Fourth Amendment provides an important check on the government's domestic surveillance powers. Second, I think the House case demonstrates how invasive these kinds of laptop searches can be. This was something that the Ninth Circuit described at length in the Cotterman decision. I believe they analogized it to a digital strip search. In House's case, the government made several copies of his files. They gave one of those copies to the Army's Criminal Investigative Division. Using keywords supplied by an assistant United States attorney with the Department of Justice, they had about 183 keywords. They ran through all of his files, you know, files potentially in the millions, and they came up with about 26,000 potentially responsive hits that they then reviewed further for any evidence of a crime. At the end of all this, they concluded that there was absolutely no evidence that House was engaged in any sort of criminal activity and no basis for seizure of the devices. I think what's worthwhile to note here is that, you know, these devices contain not just House's records in connection with the Bradley Manning support network, including, you know, anonymous donors, funding records, legal strategies, et cetera. They also included personal files, photographs, financial records. I mean, everything that you can use to look into a person's life is there. And I think increasingly, as we store our lives in these kinds of devices, they will offer a vista into everything that a person has experienced up to that point. Finally, I think the House case is troubling insofar as it shows how the government goes about these searches. ICE policy states that generally these searches should be completed within 30 days. Here it took the government 49 days to relinquish House's devices and return them to him. As you can imagine, for a computer programmer, the loss of your laptop for that period is incredibly inconvenient. And then on top of that, you know, they made multiple copies of these devices. At one point, they were unable to do any further analysis because a fan in the cooling room had broken down. Analysts went on leave. There's the settlement documents describing this process of how they conducted the search reveal bickering between various parts of the agency. And so it's just not a reassuring look into how the bureaucracy handles what is really someone's most private information. And so I think to the extent that those are issues we're all concerned about, the House case is very troubling. Now, obviously, the Cotterman decision is not a perfect fix to these issues. It raises several questions, you know, about what the difference is between a manual search and a forensic search. There's a question about whether or not it waters down the reasonable suspicion requirement. But I do think the idea of requiring reasonable suspicion for electronic device searches at the border addresses many of the problems that were raised in House. So first, it makes it much less likely for the government to use border search powers for reasons entirely unrelated to the reason it gets those powers. In other words, entirely unrelated to customs protection. You know, if the government needs to get reasonable suspicion, that'll make it much less appetizing, you know, as opposed to going to seek a probable cause warrant domestically. Second, it addresses the significant privacy and convenience interests that are implicated when the government takes this kind of very personal information. And finally, on a related note, to the extent that there is the opportunity for impermissible motives to come into play, whether or not it's political ideology or race, et cetera, a reasonable suspicion requirement by forcing agents to come up with objective criteria that a neutral magistrate can evaluate professionalizes the customs process in a way that makes it much harder for those sort of impermissible criteria to creep in. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Andrew.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks again to the Federal Society for inviting me to participate today. I just want to restate the disclaimer up front that I am speaking on my personal behalf and as a former DHS employee from 06 to 09 and not as an Accenture employee. But before I get to the Cotterman decision, I thought it would be useful just to back up a little bit and provide some context about the job of Customs and Border Protection and ICE at the border. There are approximately 400 million travelers that present themselves at U.S. borders a year, and Customs and ICE together enforce approximately 600 different laws, and they range everything from immigration to drugs, intellectual property and other sort of import-export laws, child pornography and human trafficking, espionage, and of course terrorism. So it's a very wide mandate, not quite as narrow, I think, maybe as Brian was suggesting a moment ago. And the Supreme Court has long recognized that the government has an inherent interest and authority to control what comes in the border, what comes in the country, and who comes in the country. And that's based in part on the traveler's diminished expectation of privacy at the border. So this border search exception that we've been talking about to the Fourth Amendment has been recognized for a long time, and actually, of course, cite the founding of the Republic as where sort of the premise of it emanates from. And so what the border search exception means in practice is that any search that takes place at the border is per se reasonable, with some very narrow exceptions that we'll get to in a second. And the need for this bright line rule is really important practically, because agents at the border really have seconds to determine whether or not to refer someone to secondary screening, which is where they will do additional questioning or additional searches, including potentially laptop searches. And sometimes, you know, the decision to refer someone to secondary screening is based on advanced law enforcement information from a database or otherwise. But other times it is solely the result of, you know, law enforcement expertise, or also known as sort of a hunch. So one example that's not relevant in the laptop, to the laptop issue, but I think is relevant just generally for context, is the case of Ahmad Rassam, the Millennium Bomber back in 1999. That was a case, in short, where he presented himself at a Canadian border, no advance notice, no individualized suspicion, but the customs agent there thought his behavior was unusual, referred him into secondary screening. They got inside his car and found hundreds of pounds of explosives, which were in transit to Los Angeles Airport, where he intended to detonate them. So there are consequences to these decisions. And so as more and more information is carried on electronic devices, obviously the searches of those devices can be an important tool. But it's also important to realize that the tool historically has been extremely selectively used. So last data I had was from 2009, but of the over 200 million travelers that were at U.S. ports of entry, Customs and Border Protection did about 1,000 laptop searches, and only 46 were actual in-depth searches. So that gives you hopefully some sense of how often these are used. And they have yielded, just a final note, useful information, including jihadist materials, information about nuclear material, video clips of IEDs being exploded. And that information was used in turn to prevent certain people from entering the country, which leads me to two points of distinction, I think, that we have to make when we talk about Cotterman and just the Fourth Amendment rights of people at the border generally. First is the distinction between arriving aliens, you know, non-citizens, and U.S. citizens. Even though Customs and Border Protection's mandate covers both, and a very important aspect of the mandate is with respect to determining who that's not a U.S. citizen should be allowed to enter the country. There are unique aspects to arriving alien status, and even though the case law is a little muddled, it seems clear that there is at least some limit to the constitutional rights that arriving aliens possess at the border, and certain limits on their due process or procedural rights. The other distinction is what I'll call ordinary law enforcement versus sort of national security intelligence efforts. Ordinary law enforcement is most of what I've been talking about thus far, but to the extent there are intelligence activities that take place at the border, they're probably better analyzed not under the border search exception, but under a separate exception to the Fourth Amendment known as the special needs exception, which is, in a nutshell, typically been applied to law enforcement efforts where the purpose of the efforts are not for ordinary law enforcement, but for some other purpose. So that's where you get oftentimes checkpoints that are intended to keep drunk drivers off the road, or searches in schools for drugs, which are intended not to arrest kids, but to make the school safer, and so forth. So prior to this Cotterman decision, case law was very clear from the Supreme Court on down that there was a broad exception at the border for searches, and the only real exception had been for quote-unquote non-routine searches, which cases clarified really were only applicable to very invasive searches of a person. And the one example that was called out in court cases had to do with a very invasive strip search. But there was never search of property or search of things that were too intrusive that they required any heightened suspicion. And a bunch of circuit courts looked at this issue as well, including the Ninth Circuit prior to Cotterman. The Fourth Circuit looked at it, so did the Second Circuit, and they refused to impose any heightened standard on computer searches or to find that the Constitution has any sort of First Amendment exception to the border search rule for expressive material. In a nutshell, they found no real reason to distinguish between paper and electronic data. Didn't really make sense that you could look at someone's briefcase in detail, but you couldn't look at the equivalent of, you know, tens or hundreds of briefcases. The interest and the principles would seem to be the same. One point of caution is that no cases had really looked into the sort of in-depth searches akin to what Cotterman is trying to address. And none of those cases really had the reasonable suspicion question squarely presented, because the facts suggest that there probably was reasonable suspicion, even if that was required. And so what was left unaddressed, still after Cotterman, but certainly before, was the full spectrum of activities that can happen with electronic media at the border. There is the initial search, there's situations where there may be technical assistance needed to get through encrypted files or password-protected files. There's true in-depth analysis of information that could take place, and then there's copying and retention of the data. And there probably is, it's fair to say, a spectrum in terms of what level of suspicion should be required around the border. I'll just tick through a few thoughts on Cotterman and turn it back over. I know I'm running a little long. So in addition to ignoring what I think are sound arguments about privacy expectations at the border and the problems with carving out exceptions to electronic media, there are some other problems. First, it strikes me as creating a huge loophole for criminals or others who would wish to do ill to the country. You can assume that anyone with anything to hide will now put things behind a password or encrypt the files or do whatever they have to do such that it can only be revealed through quote-unquote forensic examination. Which leads to the second problem, that it's a really unworkable standard. As the dissent points out in the case, what a forensic analysis quote-unquote is unclear from the decision. It'll probably change over time. You know, does that mean an examination just required to gain access to the data in the case of a password protected file? Or does it mean actually analyzing the data to see what you have? Third is that practically there's a real chilling effect I think this will have on border agents. You know, to try to draw the line between when is a search so in-depth or so forensic that it requires reasonable suspicion, I think will have a chilling effect and cause people to be less inclined to do searches because of the risk of litigation or discipline down the road. And as Brian said, this is probably one point of agreement, is you do run the risk when you create this reasonable suspicion standard that it will be watered down. That and this has implications not just at the border, but everywhere reasonable suspicion is the standard, right? So if I think courts will probably shy away from wanting to reverse convictions that are had based on these border searches. And so you may see, like in Cotterman, arguably, the court saying, yes, there was reasonable suspicion, where, you know, on the street in Detroit, courts would probably wouldn't say that. And then my final point, and I'll turn it back, is most of the cases where this, where the issue has been analyzed, have to do with child pornography. I think that's true of all the circuit cases I mentioned, and it's true of Cotterman. And it's problematic doctrinally, because the rules obviously will apply to all border searches. But unlike child pornography, in many cases, the contraband that's relevant to CBP submission at the border is not readily apparent on its face. So terrorism is a good example, terrorism-related issues. And terrorism, of course, is an aspect of inadmissibility for arriving aliens, so it's very important to suss out any terrorist connections or suspected terrorist connections for when the customs is making the decision about whether to admit people. But oftentimes the data that you will see on a computer, even assuming you can get access to it, really needs to be analyzed, even just translated sometimes, in order to understand what it is that you're looking at and determine whether there is grounds for any additional law enforcement action. And so that type of case has not really been presented. You know, in the child pornography cases, obviously, you turn on the computer, and most cases you see, you know, if you get access to the files, you will see what they represent, and you know, the contraband aspect is apparent on its face. So with that, I will turn it back.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. So I want to thank, first of all, Brian and Andrew for those excellent opening statements. I think now we'll go to the floor for your questions. Let me explain quickly how to ask a question. You'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and then the pound key.
While we're waiting for...
I wanted to go ahead while we're waiting for our first question. Brian, did you want to take a minute to address anything in Andrew's presentation?
Sure. I'll raise just a few quick points in response. First, with regards to the reasonable suspicion requirement generally, I don't think it's necessarily quite as burdensome as it's sometimes made out to be. Reasonable suspicion does not deprive the government of the ability to follow hunches or to use its expertise. It requires the government merely, when it does so, to provide some objective, articulable basis for what those hunches were. It's, you know, it's the lowest quantum of suspicion we have. And so to the extent that it's imposed, I think that the effect it will have in deterring, you know, government ability to suss out contraband is relatively minor. Relatedly, with respect to the chilling effect point, I would just point out that, you know, with regards to affirmative litigation initiated against agents for searches that, you know, end up not having reasonable suspicion, in addition to the already low bar of reasonable suspicion, there is, of course, in addition, the qualified immunity doctrine that provides additional protection to ensure that agents aren't unnecessarily chilled in the prosecution of their duties. So I think with a combination of those things, the chilling effect this might have, you know, when an agent has a good hunch, might be overstated. And so I think it's important to look at this from a cost-benefit analysis perspective. You have to discount whatever, you know, the likelihood is that they find something significant by the odds that only a suspicionless search could have come across that evidence. And then that has to be weighed against the aggregate harm of the number of innocent people who've had their entire lives opened to government surveillance as a result of a suspicionless search doctrine. And on that point, I would just cite Chief Judge Kaczynski's dissent in the Seljan case, United States versus Seljan, where he pointed out that, you know, pretty much all of the Supreme Court's suspicionless search doctrine cases are about contraband. They're container cases. The idea that someone's personal information, their diary, their personal correspondence could actually be read by the government has never been countenanced by the Supreme Court. The closest they came was in Ramsey, and there they noted particularly that the people who were inspecting the packages coming through to the country were not allowed to read the letters that they were opening, essentially. this goes back, I think, you know, as far as the founding. Chief Judge Kaczynski cites the Wilkes case, where people considered the idea that government agents might read their personal correspondence under a general warrant as like the most abhorrent thing possible. They likened it to being put on the rack. And so this is something that the founders are very much concerned about, and I think that's why the Fourth Amendment provides explicit protection for papers in addition to effects. The idea that these things embody our freedom of conscience was important to the founders, and I think that's why the Fourth Amendment gave it special place.
Great. Well, this is Christian again. I think we're ready to go to our first question now. We do have one question on the line. So again, if you'd like to get in line to ask a question, please press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we should disaggregate the various kinds of inspections and refer to the constitutional authorization, implied authorization, that it is permissible to set up inspection stations, presumably at borders, for the inspection of goods and presumably also people, and that the border of the nation to admit immigrants or returning citizens, or at between states for the examination of goods that could be subject to regulation or that could be taxed. There are different purposes involved and different regimes appropriate. And when, although someone may be required to pass through an inspection station, there is no right to go through an inspection station. And if a person does not consent to a search, then EOS has the option of not continuing through the inspection station but being turned back. So it seems the only remedy, however, for, or the only power of a government to search is if the entrant or person passing through consents to the search. And if he doesn't, their only power is to send him back. Is not to proceed with the search. Perhaps you can comment on that.
Well, it's an interesting, the point about withdrawing from examination, I think it's a little more complicated, and I confess my recollection of all the lines that have been drawn is a little hazy, but I do believe, at least in the airport context, which is treated as the international airport, as the functional equivalent of a border, I believe, and maybe it's only when you, of course, it's only when you've been selected for secondary screening, but that you're not permitted to just say no thanks and walk away. I think I have that right. Brian may recall.
I think that's correct.
Go ahead. Okay. But you do raise something that made me think of a response to what Brian said before, too, which is that, you know, the border is just different, and I think courts have long recognized that. So all the principles on which the Fourth Amendment is based and the founders had in mind when they crafted it for U.S. citizens in the country are a little bit beside the point when you're talking about examining what is coming into the country at the U.S. border. This is in part because of the immigrant aspect, the fact that you're examining people who do not have any constitutional right to come in the country in the first place. But I think also courts have recognized that presenting yourself at the border is a conscious choice. To your point, sir, about the ability to walk away, you know, you present yourself there voluntarily. You bring with you what you want to the border, and so that's very different than someone knocking at your door in your home and asking to see your papers.
So to respond briefly to Andrew's point, this is Brian House talking, by the way. To respond briefly to Andrew's point, I agree that the border is different, and for that very reason, there is no warrant requirement at the border. But the Supreme Court has also long recognized that just because the border is different doesn't mean that the Fourth Amendment evaporates entirely. And that's why I think they carved out a particular exception for strip searches in that case. And while it's certainly true, I think that you choose to travel internationally sometimes, although often it's part of family obligations or work obligations. That sort of travel implicates, I think, important liberty interests that would be it would be very problematic if the government's theory were essentially that they can condition those liberty interests on a consent to a full search. I mean, for example, if the government were to suggest that everybody, in order to travel internationally, had to consent to a full strip search, including the Alimentary Canal, I think courts would rightly find that to violate the Fourth Amendment. So I think the consent issue doesn't quite cover the whole range of problems presented by the border.
Right. I'll just a quick follow-up. This is Andrew. I mean, the problem with the going to the example of the strip search is it's the obvious one that the dissent pointed out as well in Cotterman. Information, no matter how personal, is not the same as a person. You know, it is a thing. And no court has found any search of any things, whether they were cars or briefcase contents or containers, to be so intrusive that, you know, they warranted a heightened scrutiny. Now, admittedly, like much of what we're discussing, courts have not squarely addressed these issues. But I think the fundamental question the courts will have to grapple with is whether, you know, a diary, for lack of, or an electronic diary or other personal information, equates to a person such that the heightened requirements that may be in place for extremely intrusive searches of actual human beings should apply to those materials.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. Our lines are open, so if you would like to ask a question from either one of our experts today, please press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key, and our lines are open. One quick programming note I want to add in. Our next scheduled telephone conference call will be this Wednesday, September 25th at noon Eastern Time, where we will host a discussion on a new book called Dumbing Down the Courts, How Politics Keeps the Smartest Judges Off the Bench, featuring the author, Dr. John R. Lott, Jr., and the president and executive director of the Committee for Justice, Kurt Levy. Again, that's Wednesday, September 25th at noon Eastern. And we do have another question on the line, so we'll go to that caller.
When does the detention for the purpose of doing these searches elevate itself to false arrest?
Sorry, I missed the beginning of the question.
Well, when they do a secondary search and pull you aside and want you to unlock your cell phone or whatever they ask you to do, I've heard stories of people being held for 6-8 hours. And abused, put in cold rooms, handcuffed, and it sure seems like an arrest to me. When would such a temporary detention be more than a simple search and become a false arrest?
I'll start, Brian. This is Andrew. I don't have a total answer to that question. I do know that the government is always mindful of the duration of searches, and that's why Brian referred to ICE's policy, for instance, about time to turn around laptop searches. And the courts, even though on different facts, have set certain parameters to when a search, duration-wise, can become unreasonable. And so my recollection is that 6 to 8 hour range is still within a reasonable time frame. I'm not aware of people being intentionally put in cold rooms, nor am I aware of ordinary cases where people are handcuffed. You could certainly imagine people being presented at the border for whom handcuffs are an appropriate step, given that you're talking about a number of criminal laws being enforced, like drug trafficking, et cetera. But in the ordinary course, that is not done. And I can't really draw the line between false arrest and these detentions. I can assume there can be some particularly egregious scenario that would give some merit to such a claim, but I'm not aware of one.
This is Brian House talking. Just to follow up on Andrew's point, I do think he's correct. That I do have some hazy recollection that the 6 to 8 hour mark has something to do with the point at which a search, in effect, becomes a seizure, and then whether or not false arrest is implicated will also stand on whether or not, you know, there was probable cause or some higher quantum of suspicion. I think that goes to the broader point of the question about you know, when the government takes these things, how long it holds on to them, and whether or not the quantum of suspicion should go up over that amount of time. I believe in Cotterman and also in House, the government rested on the idea that, you know, once something was picked up at the border, because it had never actually entered the country, the government under the border search doctrine could hold on to it indefinitely, as long as it needed, essentially, to go through all the information in the laptop or in the phone, say. And given the extensive amount of information that these devices contain, that can be an incredibly long period of time. And so I think the courts have quite rightly held that the longer the government holds on to these things, the more suspicion it needs for that sort of seizure to be reasonable, even under the border search doctrine.
Right. And on that point, Brian, I don't think the government, at least it didn't when I was more closely involved, really resisted that concept. The lines, I'm sure people would disagree about where the lines are drawn, but that's why the policy you mentioned about ICE and CBP has a analogous policy in their public, and they set timelines about review, and essentially what they stand for is that at a certain point, the government has to either determine there's probable cause to keep and to seize the information consistent with its law enforcement authority, or return it, or often destroy it. Because one thing, I mean, the House case is a little different, it sounds like, in the sense that they retain the computer. Oftentimes, there will be an image made in part so that the person can go on his way and take the computer, unless there's obviously some overriding law enforcement reason to retain it. But that also gets around some of the duration problems of having someone wait to stand by. I mean, I think, you know, all this, one thing the Ninth Circuit had to address is this idea of password-protected files. I mean, it does, just to go back to one point I made, seem a little bit crazy to put the onus on the government time-wise when a traveler, particularly if there is reasonable suspicion of illegal activity, has decided to encrypt or otherwise make, you know, more challenging to enter into files. The government's technology is good, but there's always, I'm sure, ways to get around it.
Can you still hear me? Can you still hear me? Yeah, I guess you.
Yep. I'm sorry.
Oh, I think the system cut him off. We've got two more questions on the line, so I think, and we've got about 20 minutes left in the call, so we do have two questions, which we should be able to get through, and then our lines will be open. So again, if you have a question, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, it's David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley. A couple of very quick comments I'd like to get the response from the speakers. One is that, you know, to what extent is this problem something that's self-correcting in that the sense that the technology with publicity having to do with government intrusion into just digital data on the internet in the first place, technology is moving forward and will likely create something along the lines of ubiquitous encryption of user data, which is easily obtainable by the average person in the future, so we'll actually avoid this issue technologically rather than having to deal with it. That's one comment. The second comment has to do with just, you know, who's being impacted here. It seems that if encryption technology is a solution to protection of private data, then the people who are most at risk to the invasion of their privacy are the ones who are the least culpable, the ones who are not hiding something. It seems to upset the balance of the what we're actually looking for and who gets the liability of the intrusion. And the last comment is that isn't the necessity for this type of border, search, undermined by the fact that there's a torrent of data flowing over the internet across international borders, which just goes largely unscrutinized?
This is Brian House talking. So with regards to the first point about whether or not there might be a technological fix for this, I think that's certainly a possibility, but as recent news stories have suggested, the NSA is continuing to reach new heights and its decryption capabilities, and partly that's through its ability to actually influence the encryption standards There was a recent New York Times article which pointed out that the NSA had actually essentially created a backdoor in the international encryption standards that allowed it a separate way to decrypt that stuff. And they did that essentially through subterfuge. But even through their advances in code breaking technology, the government has pretty sophisticated decryption technologies, and so it's questionable whether or not I think decryption software will effectively outpace the government anytime in the near future. With regards to the second point, I completely agree that people who manage to encrypt their data should not get more legal protection than people who don't. Certainly, I think even under the Ninth Circuit's forensic manual distinction in Cotterman, it would be the case that if someone had simply password protected their files without going through any sort of very rigorous encryption process, the government would still need to show reasonable suspicion to get through that password protection, regardless, and it shouldn't matter, how high-tech your lock is. If the government needs to break any sort of lock, even if it's just a matter of guessing the password, my hunch is that Cotterman would require reasonable suspicion in those circumstances. But really, I think that, and this is where I disagree with the Ninth Circuit's decision, anytime the government wants to search this kind of information, it shouldn't matter whether or not you've encrypted it. As you say, oftentimes it can be the most innocent people who don't think to encrypt their files. And so I think the government should actually be required to prove reasonable suspicion in all those circumstances, regardless of whether or not encryption is at play.
Hi, this is Andrew. I mean, my view is somewhat similar on the encryption point. I mean, I think an important thing to keep in mind is that the law enforcement mandate that the government has at the border has not changed in the last 10, 20, 30 years. It hasn't lessened, I should say. It's only expanded in the wake of 9/11 and other national security concerns. So the mandate's the same. Congress has not chosen to pull it back at all. The only thing that's really changed is the technology, which I don't mean to downplay, but that's what's changed, not the job that Customs and others have to do at the border. So in the same way, you couldn't show up at the border with a briefcase and a special new lock, and somehow that the government wouldn't attempt to crack it. I mean, I suspect to the extent the encryption publicly becomes more sophisticated, the government will attempt to keep up with it so that they can do their job. I mean, unless and until Congress wants to pull back the mission and say, you don't have to investigate or try to enforce certain laws, I'm not sure they have a real option. And just to Brian's last point, the Cotterman decision either and a reasonable suspicion standard will either undercut the effectiveness of the law enforcement people are doing precisely, sir, because of what you said, that people with nothing to hide will come with unencrypted or unpassword protected files, and those that have anything to hide will certainly do that. And so either you won't be able to look at that stuff, and I'm putting to the side situations where there's advanced law enforcement notice, right? Because clearly in those cases, I should say, I would expect in those cases, a court would find reasonable suspicion. But put those aside. Either you can't get into those files, or the reasonable suspicion standard really is sort of meaningless. And Brian talked about this a little bit before, that it's not such a hurdle. But I guess I'm a little confused with that, because if seeing someone in line, and maybe they're sweating, maybe they're fidgety, you can read different cases, and get a sense of some of the subjective elements the border agents may take into consideration. If those constitute reasonable suspicion, then I guess there's really no concern here. But those, to me, don't seem like the type of individualized suspicion that a court would demand, on a street corner. So I guess I can imagine courts pushing the reasonable suspicion threshold so low that it would have no effect. But I don't have a lot of confidence that that's how the standard would be applied.
To respond quickly to Andrew's point, I agree that if someone looks sweaty or fidgety in line, that wouldn't be enough for reasonable suspicion either in a Terry stop context or at the border under the Cotterman decision. But I would argue essentially that shouldn't be the basis for opening up the entire contents of their life, essentially, that they're storing on these laptops now. That just because someone looks sweaty or fidgety is not really a good basis for invading their privacy rights in such a fundamental way. And that to the extent the reasonable suspicion requirement forces customs agents like police officers into a more professionalized, more scientific method of deciding who to subject to these searches, I think it's a good thing.
Great. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. It looks like we've got a couple more questions on the line and about 12 minutes left on the call. So I would ask our callers to please keep your questions as brief as possible so that we can try to get through all the remaining questions on the line.
Hi. As an international traveler with a laptop, I have a very generic question, which is how often does the removal of a laptop from a traveler occur as a practical question, just suspicionless or otherwise. Second, it does seem like encryption is becoming more ubiquitous. One of my laptops, I have several, came from the factory with full disk encryption enabled. The others did not, and so the question is, why can't the government, if they're going to try and say, well, we can make copies of these files for our perusal, why can't they, if they're going to assert that authority, why can't they at least provide funding to do that quickly so that I'm not deprived of my laptop for more than, say, the time that it takes to duplicate a hard drive? And if I do travel through with the hard drive with the full disk encryption, which I say came from China that way, why does that automatically make it more suspicious? That doesn't seem to be reasonable. And nobody answered the question that was asked earlier about, gee, we send an awful lot of bits across the border, and I don't think anybody's, the NSA is definitely doing their level best, but I don't think anybody's stopping them and copying them at the border and preventing them from advancing into or out of the country. Why doesn't, if I were a motivated terrorist, why wouldn't I merely send the bits over the border that way, travel through with my laptop with no data on it, and retrieve the data on the other side? It just seems silly. We're only catching people who aren't smart.
This is Brian House talking. So with regards to the first question about how many times these searches happen, I have a link here to some government records which suggest that in the period between October 1st, 2012 and August 31st, 2013, 4,957 passengers had their electronic devices searched. In the previous year, the numbers are 4,898. Now, I'm not sure, unfortunately, the data provided to us by the government on those searches, I don't think, indicates how many of them actually involved the removal of the laptop from the passenger's possession, but that gives, I think, some idea of about how often these sorts of suspicionless border laptop searches or other electronic device searches happen. With regards to the point about why can't the government do this quickly and cost-effectively, I think that's a very good question. The settlement documents that we obtained in the House case show that like one of the major issues the government encountered when trying to analyze House's laptop was just that it ran Linux software, and the government Homeland Security Investigations, which was handling this, just didn't have any technical analysts on hand who were particularly proficient in Linux software, which is a relatively mainstream operating system. And so I think that goes to show some of the inconveniences that these sorts of searches subject travelers to for reasons having entirely to do with, underfunded government. And I think that goes to show why this is not necessarily the sort of power we want to entrust to that sort of bureaucracy, especially not just for inconvenience reasons, but also because really important data is at stake here. And if somehow that data were to be released or somehow jeopardized, that could seriously harm somebody's life. And finally, with regards to the question about whether or not the fact that these files can be transmitted over the internet changes things, I think it does go to show that the interest in intercepting this information at the border is not really a contraband issue so much as it is a generalized law enforcement. The government's interest in getting this stuff at the border is really no different than its interest in getting this stuff within the country. Nevertheless, within the country, we require full compliance with the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement. And so I think that goes to show why this idea that the border is really special doesn't track historically with the kinds of things that the border search was meant to protect, such as preventing narcotics or other illegal drugs from physically entering the country.
Okay, it's Andrew. I'll try to take these in turn. The numbers, I have no reason to dispute the numbers that Brian cited. I mean, it's important to keep in mind those probably are in relation to several hundred million travelers that come to the border, so to get a proportional sense here. And I'm sure if there are 4,000 and change that were searched, an even smaller percentage of those were actually removed from the traveler. The point about sort of expertise and the time it takes to analyze data, I'm sure no one in government would say that there aren't additional needs for resources, particularly in law enforcement. But like I said, in many cases, I know they try to obtain a copy of a hard drive precisely so they don't have to hold up a traveler indefinitely. But when you consider the many priorities that law enforcement has at the border and otherwise, and you consider the myriad ways that a laptop can show up and the different sorts of encryptions or protections people can put on them, I'm not qualified to say what the right amount of time is or what's unreasonable, but I'm sure people move. I can assure you, in the law enforcement context, people are moving as quickly as they can. And the law enforcement context is what you have at the border. I'm not quite sure I understand the distinction. They are enforcing, customs is charged with enforcing hundreds of laws, criminal laws and otherwise. And there is something special about the border that I think is getting a little bit lost, and that is the immigration enforcement role. There is a big difference in finding information on an arriving alien at the border and turning them around than, in Chicago, through a regular law enforcement investigation, finding that information. And the difference is the ease with which you can remove someone from the country that's here. And that's part of why I think the courts have empowered border agents. There's a real national security and law enforcement benefit to be able to turn people around at the border based on what you find there. Now, sometimes what they'll do is you let someone into the country, it's sort of legal fiction, but they haven't really entered, and they can be removed later if the analysis turns out some problematic data. But that's a big distinction. And then finally, about the internet point, I don't really have a good answer, except, I mean, if all people who wanted to do bad started sending stuff over the internet, didn't show up with laptops or had blank laptops, law enforcement would direct their efforts elsewhere. I'm not sure that bears on what the scope of authority should be at the border.
Best Buy has people who can duplicate any hard drive in any laptop, and they don't have a heck of a lot of training or a lot of expensive tools available. 49 days to be deprived of a computer is totally unreasonable. I can't see any rational basis for it being gone for more than a couple of hours to be duplicated if there's any serious attempt by the government to minimize the inconvenience to the 4,000 and change passengers.
Right. Well, just to be clear, no one suggested that 4,000 people had their computers gone for anywhere close to that amount of time, nor do we really know the specifics of the case. I can only assure you this much, which is that if there was a real, if there was cause to copy a computer because there were national security concerns, it wouldn't be sitting on a shelf for 50 hours. I mean, that's at the far end of the spectrum to retain the actual device. So we sort of need to know a little bit more to understand why, but that's inconsistent with stated public policy for these agencies. And so I suspect there was some reason.
This is Brian House talking. If I could respond just really quickly. I think that's what makes the House case so interesting is specifically because the government cited national security concerns in discussing why House, it needed to conduct this investigation on House. And then despite those national security concerns about WikiLeaks and stuff like that, it was precisely in his case that the computer seemed to sit on the shelf for so long. But that aside, I think one of the things that the Ninth Circuit was really trying to get at in Cotterman was this question about what is the actual limiting principle on the government's power to keep these things for so long. One of the questions that the judges asked at oral argument is, does the government assert the power have every person who checks in at the border provide the laptop, and the government will review it as necessary and forward it on to them within a week, a month, a year, however long it takes. They asked the United States attorney arguing that case whether the government asserted that power, and he said yes, that there is essentially no limiting principle on the border search doctrine with regards to that issue. And so I think that's what the court found really troubling, and I would agree with that.
Well, one final thing to keep in mind, though, is that there can be a limiting principle put in place somewhere other than the constitutional interpretation. So the government has policies, it imposes its own standards in terms of, in some cases, heightened level of suspicion, for instance, like I said before, it sort of exists on a spectrum. But that's a different question than whether, in interpreting the Fourth Amendment and its long-held exceptions, you know, we should impose such a standard.
This is Christian. We have a couple minutes left. Are both of our experts, are you guys okay to do take one more question?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah, with regard to the statement that you haven't heard of people being detained for a long time, there's a story onthemedia.org. It was on the radio on NPR this weekend, and on the media producer was detained with her family for many hours under very uncomfortable conditions, allegedly while they were looking through the laptop. They also called another agency to come and take another look at one of the people who had apparently an unpaid traffic ticket for a crooked license plate in the state of Michigan. And it just seems like the whole group was under false arrest to me.
I'm not familiar enough with the case to really comment. I'd be interested to know a little more about it, including, you know, how long and were they U.S. citizens? Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Were they U.S. citizens or not?
No, they were U.S. citizens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, since that went quickly, maybe we can squeeze in one more quick question. That'll be our last caller that's on the line.
John Rowland, Constitution.org again. There is a problem with turning back at the border a U.S. citizen. Now, there's no doubt about the power to turn back an alien at the border, so that you can't pass through. But if you turn back a U.S. citizen because he doesn't consent to a search, then that raises another kind of constitutional issue and does seem to me to require a Fourth Amendment warrant. Even though it's an inspection point, if it can be shown not to be contraband subject to regulation or substance or detaxation, then there would seem to be no subject matter jurisdiction. And there's also a problem that if the encryption is strong, the government cannot crack it, not yet, or in the foreseeable future. They can crack weak encryption. But if there's evidence that it's strong encryption, then keeping the computer or copy of the disk forever is not going to help them. And it opens the question of whether it's reasonable for them to keep it if they can't crack it.
Do either of you want to respond?
I certainly agree that the U.S. citizen brings with him or her sort of a unique analysis, including, like you mentioned, the ability to turn them away, which is not ordinarily done. And I agree with you on the encryption point. I mean, that's what I was saying before. Notwithstanding Best Buy's employees' expertise, I don't think it's as simple as was made to seem earlier.
In response, quickly to the encryption point, I think, you know, at least in the House case, the evidence was not that he had strong encryption of his files. The files were simply password protected. The main reason for the delay cited in the government's records was simply, first, that they weren't familiar with the Linux operating system he was using, and then there was this problem where I guess the fan in the room that was housing the computer broke down, and then the analyst had to go away on sick leave for a while, and then somebody went into mourning. And so it was not so much the encryption that was holding up the investigation as it was a series of unfortunate events, and I think that goes to show the problems there. the government's ability to detain the device itself, I think, certainly should not be conditioned, on the level of encryption that the person chooses to use. So if a person happens to encrypt their device, I don't think that that means the government gets to keep it forever just because the person happened to employ privacy protections that the Department of Justice itself recommends that all its employees use. So certainly, I think when the government intends to seize a device for a prolonged period of time, the suspicion it needs for that goes up, regardless of the encryption on the device.
Andrew, do you want to take just a minute and give any final thoughts before we end?
I'm happy to. I mean, I think it's been a good discussion. I think it's important to keep in mind the complexity and the variability of the mandate that we've put on agents at the border. And although the technology will change and will continue to change, which is another problem, I think, with the Ninth Circuit's decision, is it's far from a bright line rule and therefore will have to be revisited if clarity is what's sought, regularly as things become, it becomes easier to store more data or quicker to de-encrypt it or what have you. And I think, just to restate, I think on the reasonable suspicion standard, although in many cases there will be sufficient evidence to meet that standard, may not be in all cases, and I don't think, and that would include, by the way, random searches that are done for deterrence value. I don't think you want to prevent that from happening. And in the terrorism context in particular, there are often links to people get linked to other people. And I do not think necessarily a court would say, pulling someone into secondary screening and looking in their laptop or wanting to analyze their laptop because they have affiliation to a known terrorist, whether that would meet the reasonable suspicion standard, but I think it's an extremely important part of the mission, both for immigration purposes as well as national security purposes. So I think having things where they were pre-Cotterman, which is to say suspicionless searches are permissible under the border search exception, and then, whether through government policy, executive branch policy, or if Congress wants to intervene, perhaps having heightened standards as you go down the timeline or across the spectrum of the type of search makes some sense, but certainly at the border and where these decisions are really made on a split-second basis, it just does not, I think, help anyone and undercuts the mission of the government to impose these heightened hurdles.
Brian, any concluding thoughts?
Sure. So the first thing I think it's important to note is that although DHS does have a broad mandate, the origin of the border search doctrine does not track DHS's mandate. The border search doctrine was not originally created to allow the government to engage in broad law enforcement powers through the border. It was created to protect the very specific interests that occur at the border, specifically the introduction of contraband into the United States. And I think when the government turns DHS into a broader law enforcement agency, then it has to start acting more like other law enforcement agencies. Further on that point, although the Ninth Circuit's reasonable suspicion requirement is new, it's addressing, I think, a sea change in really what's happened with technology now. The previous suspicionless search cases involved stuff like cars or trunks or briefcases. None of those really approach a laptop in their ability to completely open up a person's personal life to review by government agents. And I think the idea that government agents could look into all of those things, essentially the equivalent of a person's home, without any sort of suspicion is something that probably would have offended the founders. And while it's true that going through this reasonable suspicion requirement will require further litigation, I think that's something that courts are able to handle. They've handled it ably in other circumstances, and I think they can handle it here. And so while it will take further development of the law, I think that's a good thing to address this new circumstance that's really never come up in our history and that needs to be dealt with in a new way.
Well, fantastic. This is Christian Corrigan again, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both our experts today, Brian House and Andrew Levy. I really appreciate both of you being on the call. Thank you to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Please join us Wednesday at noon Eastern for our next scheduled Teleform call. That's, again, Wednesday at noon Eastern. And be sure to check out our new Executive Branch Review Project blog, www.executivebranchproject.com. So until Wednesday at noon Eastern, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.